ladies and gentlemen. First, let me express again my gratitude to Enrique Garcia, president of CAF and the LSE, for associating Africa to this important event. I think one thing was missing in the biography of Enrique Garcia is his religion. Enrique Garcia is a firm believer in the emergence of the South. We met in 2006 when we were founding the global network of Exim Bank and Development Finance Institutions, which is a South-South initiative. So I'm not surprised to see Enrique again leading such an initiative, which is a forum which will enable us to think more thoroughly and more systematically about the role and the place that the South should have in the evolving world. We have quite impressive speakers here to set up the stage. We'll start with the mapping of the global change, and I would like to invite, without further ado, Bindu Loane, who is Vice President, Knowledge Management and Sustainable Development at the Asian Development Bank, to start with his presentation. The format we've adopted is a format whereby presenters will have about 10 minutes to talk about their contribution to these important topics. And then after the round of presentations, then we will get to question and answers. So let me invite Bindu. You have the stage.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to thank CAF LSE for inviting the Asian Development Bank to this very interesting meeting. I must thank especially President Garcia for my president. We are very good friends. We have a memorandum of understanding, among many other things. One of the areas we agreed to do is knowledge sharing. So this really fits in with that agenda. Thank you very much, President. Coming from the Asian Development Bank, I guess I would be expected to speak from the Asian perspective, and I will do that. First, if you look at the long-term outlook for Asia, and that's what I will try to say a few things first. If you look at 2010 figure, 28% of the GDP was Asia. The projections done on Asia 2050, the book there, and with people like him and others at the ADB, Asia had the potential to have 52% of the global GDP by 2050. Now that's sizable. We call that the possibility of an Asian century. Although some people like it, some people envy it, but that's how the report says it. And this will be led by 7 economies. Now that's not a very good sign. There are many countries, but 7 are going to be dominant. But that's what the report says. But the scenario is not preordained. There are many mega challenges Asia will need to face. Let me mention about a few quickly. First, addressing the inequality issues, very serious in Asia, and it's growing. I do not want to bore you with the numbers like Gini coefficients, how it's been, but it's been rising, and it's been rising. Massive urbanization. Nowhere in the history of the world ever seen the kind of urbanization Asia is seeing today. We may have 1.1 billion people move to the city in the next 20 years. 120,000 people move every day. Huge Asian. 70% of the Asians are expected to live in the cities by 2030 or 2040. Huge problem. The global competition for finite resources. By 2050, 40% of the global energy will be consumed by Asia. We heard this morning the 40% of the resources exist in Asia by President Iglesias, but they're also the big consumers of every other form of resources. Regional cooperation and economic integration. It was mentioned by President Garcia also during the last discussions. What we're concerned about, the disparity across the countries in the sub-region. The disparity across the countries increased risk, migration, and of course even tension and even conflicts. If you go back to the history of our region, there have been many conflicts, and you know, if these happens, people are worried. The middle-income trap. Harinder, 3 billion people will be in the middle-income, will be the in the middle-income area, zone. But Asia will need to try very hard how to avoid the middle-income trap. And this is probably true with many emerging countries across the world. And finally, the global warming, climate change. Yes, certainly it's an issue to our Asia. I will explain a little bit more. But even in addition to that, the problem of environment pollution. Those of you who have gone to Beijing, to our India, other places, you see air pollution, water pollution impacting public health and economic losses. Let me just check. If I have to extract three of these issues for us, it will be addressing the inequalities and disparities. And this is not a finished agenda. Development Bank like us, others, been talking about inclusive growth. I don't think we've been able to crack the nut yet. It is there. The countries also have a lot to do. The second is how to avoid middle-income trap. I mentioned the Asian century where we may have 52% of the global GDP. The downside, if those mega challenges are not addressed, Asia may come down to about 31, 32% of the GDP, which means from 28 now to 32 in the 2050 is not a scenario one would like to see. That's what is the middle-income trap scenario. In order to avoid this middle-income trap, we're undertaking some work, and we're a strong believer that these middle-income countries need to get into knowledge economy. This is where the President Iglesias said about the education revolution at the higher end. It's happening, but it's not happening enough. I'll give you one example. If you look at some of the data of the graduates, even the engineers, only 25% of the engineers after they graduate have the skills required for the employers to be employed. And in the case of social science, it's about 15%. In even countries like India and China. That's what one of the reports shows. So Asians are probably obsessed with having degrees, but not necessarily the skills. And this is a major problem we have at the moment. I do agree with the President Iglesias that we need education revolutions at the tertiary levels included to build in the kind of technological capability and move into the knowledge economy. If we compare with the OECD countries, we're far behind in the knowledge gap, far, far behind. Our studies confirm that. The second thing countries are trying to, and we think they need to do, is to have some structural transformation. Agriculture to industry, industry to service sector. Some countries have been trying to move directly from agriculture to service industry. They have caught themselves into the middle-income trap. As I mentioned, 70% are going to be living in the urban areas. So nobody wants to live in the rural areas. So what happens? Who's going to produce food? Who's going to take care of that rural development? It's a huge structural issue we need to handle. And the climate change agenda, our studies show 5 to 10% of the GDP could be lost. The huge adaptation investment needed, and we have not got a real handle on this one, and the pollution issues which I mentioned. The good news is the countries are beginning to think about green growth. I sit in one committee in China with a distinguished scholar, and the Chinese are really interested how to move into the green growth part. Not because it's a fashion, but it's really hurting their economy quite a bit, and more countries would be doing that. The second area I'd like to briefly mention is the South-South cooperation that's happening first in Asia and Asia with the other region. Our intra-Asian trade is about 55% in 2012. Korea's number one export is to China now. It's no longer United States. So there are changing trade patterns in the region that we see. Number of FTA signed has reached something like 257 in 2013, a sign that something at the global level is not working. The ASEAN Economic Community, the 10 countries, by 2015 will have a free trade zone, and there will be free movement of skilled labor. So this is happening in Asia as we speak. But Asia is also having a lot of South-South relationship with other regions. For example, the export to Latin America grew 7 times, imports by 13 times. With Africa, both imports and exports grew about 9 times. But when you look at the total volume, still much less. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more South-to-South cooperation that is needed and that's possible. A few things that we can do, in addition to strengthening the trade and investment regimes, there's a scope of cooperation could go beyond that in the financial sector, which hasn't happened very much yet. In the regional public goods, we need to have some common voice and some common issues globally, and in the knowledge-sharing area. Increasingly, I find our Asian countries are looking at Latin American for some of the success stories. Think like, as you was mentioned in the morning, the conditional cash transfer. This is something which Asians are finding very useful. And such knowledge-sharing events, in my opinion, has to happen even more. And in the next 2 minutes, I have what I'm going to say is about the South is starting to also exert its influence at the global level. We heard quite a bit from President Iglesias before. At the APEC, WTO, G20 was mentioned, although not very happy. The only thing happy for me, G20, is it's become from G7 to G20. People are not talking G7 anymore, but I do agree everything else, President, you mentioned it. Even at the time of 2008 crisis, the financial cooperation was not all that great. What I see is, again, need to be happening is, or not happening, as we may want to say, it is for the South to speak with one voice. I don't know how. Maybe it's a part of governance structure we might need. But we are not doing it a lot, but we could do more in future. I also would like to end by saying that whether there's in this whole South-South and the cooperation, as well as the Asia's rising Asia, as we may say, in the context of today's discussion, what's been the role of multilateral bank like ours? We find that in this process, they need an honest broker. And if you can fill that role, they will accept you or accept us. And we've been pretty successful in doing that in the infrastructure space. President Garcia mentioned in his own reason. We're trying to get involved in the financial cooperation, financial integration is happening, but it's not happening in the speed it should happen. And this is a role which we need to do more. And finally, in the third area where we think we need to do more is on the knowledge sharing with the countries. The countries do not want our money alone. We're a development bank. They say, in addition to the cheap money we provide, they say, what else? Bring us knowledge, global knowledge. We can do in the past, we used to say, Asian solution to Asian problems, and we are very good in solving the Asian problem with Asian knowledge. The countries are not happy. Now they say, please bring me global knowledge. So we're going to have our challenge is solving Asian problems to Asian solution to Asian problem with global knowledge. So we're very hungry for knowledge sharing with all regions. And I think the forum like this, in my opinion, would be very, very useful. And thank you once again for inviting us.
Well, thank you, Bindu Luani, for keeping time. Let me now invite Harinder Kohli, to make his presentation on Global South as development actors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Professor Alden, President Garcia, and President Iglesias. It's wonderful to be here for the first CAF LSE conference, given the strong start we've already made this morning and the attendance. I'm sure that you will have many future successful meetings beyond the first one, and we look forward to the outcomes and the debate that we'll have. President Garcia has given me a very simple job, and that is to try to summarize for you the findings of three major books that we've done in the last 2-3 years. And they're all available there. The books are, the first one was sponsored by CAF, by President Garcia, Latin America 2040, which is currently in second edition, and it is available both in English and Spanish. The second book was sponsored by ADB, and Bindu has already tried to give you highlights of that. That's called Asia 2050. And the third one, the sponsor is sitting right in front of me, Mr. Jane, is being released today, Africa 2050. It is commissioned by the African Union and Economic Commission for Africa, and has just come out today in front of you. So in all, I think these books, Anil, who is my co-author, we have written over 1,000 pages, and I have, I think, 9 minutes left to summarize that. Now, but the second complication is that President Garcia, who's a very visionary man, as you've already seen, has posed a challenge to us. That is to go beyond these three regional geographic-oriented studies and prepare a comprehensive global study into where the developing countries, really the world economy as a whole, are likely to be in 2050. And I'm also supposed to summarize with you a little bit of initial work that we completed on that. So, how do I do that? Fortunately, President Iglesias has already in his keynote speech summarized so well so many issues, both of today and future. So I'll take liberty of just mentioning him but not repeating those issues. And of course, Bindu has already given you highlights of the Asia book. So let me try then to meet my task by dividing my remarks into three parts. The first is to tell you, the young generation, the future, as to how far the world has come during our generation's lifetimes in the last 50, 60 years since most countries, developing countries, gained independence, beginning in South Asia, India, Pakistan, then Bangladesh. But then the movement of, if you would, liberation or independence spread to Africa, and the process was completed in the mid-60s, with some countries left into the late 60s. So what has happened in these 50, 60 years? Where are we coming from? The second part would be, where are we going? Where are we likely to go? Not will go, as Bindu said, is not preordained. Nobody knows what will happen 40 years from now, but I'll paint for you a few scenarios which we prepared for the world as a whole through our global model, which covers 184 countries, if I'm correct, and looks between from 1950 to 2050 for about 100 years. So what does that model say in different scenarios? And third is to repeat some of the issues you've already heard about, which must be tackled in order what a positive outcome scenario can really occur. And then finally mention very briefly the massive opportunity cost of failure in case things are not done well, in case things don't go well because of what happens within the countries, how big a cost some 5 billion people who live in developing countries will pay. So with that, we know from Madison, who has traced the economic history of the world, that prior to the Industrial Revolution, just two countries in the world, in Asia, China and India, accounted for roughly 50% of global GDP. As a result of the Industrial Revolution, productivity and competitiveness of first Europe and then North America rose very dramatically, And as a result, they gained more and more share of the global GDP to the extent that by mid-1950s, when our generation was going up, the share of Asia dropped to no more than 12% of global GDP until the reversal started, first with Japan and then Korea, Singapore, and more recently China and India. So that's where we were. And today, actually I'll give you numbers of 2012. As Bindu has alluded, Asia's share of global GDP has already risen to 28%. But it's still a far cry from 50% which just the two countries had. If you look at the world today, Asia accounts for 29 or 30%.
Yeah.
North America accounts for 24%, and Europe 29%. So Asia is already one of the three big regions of the world, and developing countries, so-called emerging markets, already account for more than 50% of global GDP. So that's where we're coming from. But more dramatically, I don't know how many of you will know that some 40 years ago, in 1981, there were 1.9 billion people who lived below the absolute poverty level of $1.25 per day income. 1.9 billion people. They accounted for roughly 50% of all people living in developing countries. Where are we today? Just in one generation, roughly there are 1 billion less people in poverty. Because of the new figures released by the Indian government 3 months ago, the total number of poor living in abject poverty in the world has dropped to 800 million compared to 1.9 billion. And the incidence of poverty has dropped from 50% to 21% worldwide. And actually, most of the poverty is concentrated in just two regions. Mr. Jane's region, where 50% of people still live in poverty, and South Asia, where roughly 21% of people live in poverty. Other regions are well below 20%, and many regions are below 10%, including Latin America and Central Asia. So the poverty issue is still there. It's not disappeared, but it's not focused on basically two regions. And we've seen tremendous progress in the last 40, 50 years. And I think the world can take a lot of credit for doing that. But the story is not finished, and there's still a long way to go. So now, second point then, let me come to where we think the world is going. So through our model, we had developed three scenarios, now consistent across regions, and they suggest that there could be a dramatic improvement between now and 2050, as a result of which, for example, Asia, as Bindu has already mentioned, will regain about half of the global GDP share. So they will go back to roughly where they were before the advent of the Industrial Revolution. So the cycle is being completed in some ways. But the point to remember is not absolute numbers, is that per capita income of Asia, which will be the best of the regions after Latin America, perhaps, per capita income of an average Asian will be still equal to an average world citizen. And it will be about one-fourth or one-fifth of income levels of people in Europe and North America. So yes, in terms of size, because of Asia will have 53-54% of global population still, it will have much bigger weight in the world, but in terms of relativity, it will still be poor. And of course, Africa is likely, despite the best forecast, will be behind it. In Latin America's future, as President Garcia said, we don't know. It depends very much on whether countries escape the middle income trap or not. But they could be. Today, Latin Americans are twice as rich as East Asians. So this is one part of the scenario I want to paint. The second part is that by 2050, four of the five largest economies in the world in PPP terms will be in Asia. In PPP terms, but also in dollar terms, market exchange rate terms. And the order will be different, but the four top countries, four of the top will be, in addition to US, will be China, India, Japan, and Indonesia, most likely. And the next five will include Mexico and Brazil. But Argentina, which used to be the richest country in the world 100 years ago, will no longer be on the top 10. So, and that's a good example of middle income trap that Bindu was talking about. Other numbers. We think that as much as 70% of global GDP could be in developing countries, today's developing countries. But again, it's not for sure. And if they fall in the middle income trap or they fall in the so-called resource curse, which many countries in Africa and Latin America have a potential of, then their share, Asia's share will be, as Bindu said, will be no more than 1/3 of the global GDP. They'll be much poorer as an average citizen of the world than an average citizen of the world. Latin America could be anywhere between 6 to 9%, 6 to 10% of global GDP. And Africa, our book says, could be anywhere between 3, which it is today, to 6% of global GDP. And the Middle East is, and Australia and New Zealand make up the rest. The developed countries would be somewhere between 30 to 45% of global GDP, depending not on what happens just in developed countries, but mainly what happens in the developing countries. So I'll come back to, you know, what is the meaning of these projections. This is what we're calling the default scenario in case things stay the way they have been in the last 10, 15 years. We have a pessimistic scenario, which is a lot worse, in case countries fall in the so-called middle income trap and don't do things well. And we have an optimistic scenario where the world as a whole does better than what it has done in the last 10 years in terms of productivity improvement. Okay? So we'll come back to that. Now, I would submit that because of the successes of our generation's work, if I may use that word, in the last 40 years, the issues will be changing very dramatically in the future. Instead of poverty, as Bindu has already mentioned, the main issue will be inequalities. And it's very interesting to me that Bindu is talking about inequalities. The fact is, the biggest disparities and inequalities are first in Latin America, which is the richest developing region of the world today, and second highest are in Africa, which is the poorest region of the world, and Asia comes out very well, including South Asia. And despite that, Bindu very correctly is saying it is an issue. Why is it an issue? We have a professor from Tsinghua, and she can talk more about it. The disparities are rising in China very dramatically. As a result, they are higher today than in Brazil. And Brazil used to be a bad place before. There is a big talk about disparities even in the US. So in my view, disparities are not anymore linked to poverty. They are linked to every country's prospects, what's happening between rich and poor. So that's an emerging issue, but not only in developing countries, but for the whole world. That's one. The second issue is climate change. So I will not go into it because Bindu has elaborated it very well. But I would just add one word to what Bindu said. It's not an issue of economics only. It's a human cost. You know, yesterday there was an article, unfortunately, Professor, about the air quality in Beijing and Shanghai. And the pollution, air pollution in Beijing rose above the scale. It cannot be measured anymore. People, there are pictures on the internet, the pictures from the windows. It's totally dark. You can't even see the next building. So it is a human cost, number of people. There's estimate, I think, that more than 1 million people extra are dying in China because of pollution every year. So it's an issue, economics for sure. But it's not an issue of 20 years from today. It's an issue today. And you already mentioned Delhi and Calcutta and Bombay and Manila, correct? Where Bindu lives. So it's a big issue. Now, similarly, I suggest that on one hand, through globalization, through technology development, we have gained productivity tremendously in the last 40, 50 years. But what is happening is productivity is replacing the number of people required to produce a product or a service. It's true throughout, even in the U.S. We're having so-called jobless recovery. Now, this is happening when the developing countries are still having a lot of young people coming into the market. Where are they going to get jobs? If they don't get jobs, are we going to see more of the Arab Spring kind of issues? And I will just mention that in case of Africa alone, there'll be 1 billion additional people coming into life, if you would, in the next 40 years. Where are they going to get jobs? And frankly, I'm quite worried that the issue of jobs is really the biggest issue in front of us for the next generation. And if we don't solve it, we could have a global Arab Spring and social disease. And that's an issue that you have to solve for us, because we'll be long gone before. Right? I think another issue is that most of the global commons, Bindu already mentioned climate change, President Iglesias mentioned trade, the issue of financial flows, financial system, issues of jobs, most of the global commons, they will be sorted out only if there's a close collaboration between developing and developed countries. I would submit, based on our own work, that the old boundaries between developed and developing countries are dissipating, and by 2050, as I already said, half of the top 10 economies in the world will be developing economies, which are today. But it's not only that. If you look at per capita income, I don't know how many of you know that Singapore is now the third richest country in the world in per capita income terms. And only 20 years ago, it was considered a developing country. Korea is now one of the richest countries in the world. So the old boundaries are going. We will see a new flock of countries which will be much more important in global economy, not only in terms of size, but also per capita income. And more the interest, the self-interest of developing and developed countries, the so-called South and the North, will begin to merge. And it will be in common interest of everybody concerned to solve the global commons issues together in a way that it's win-win for everyone. And that brings me to the last point, which was emphasized very much by President Iglesias. It has major implications for global governance. And I would submit that from G7 to G20, we have seen that evolution in the last 40 years, and what it will be 40 years from now will be very, very different. And not just World Bank and IMF, but every single institution, and we'll need to find new ways to collaborate and solve global problems. So with that, I should add something which has not been mentioned, issue of corruption and governance. Since the increase in role of private sector and globalization, corruption has become a bigger and bigger issue. At the same time, policy issues are more difficult to implement, and poor governance, poor institutions really make it very difficult. So what happens in the future, to me, depends very much on what happens in governance. And can developing countries of today, can South of today, improve the quality and effectiveness of institutions? If they don't, and that's my last point, and I finish there, Mr. Chairman. If they don't, the so-called pessimistic scenario that I'd just like to paint for you, will come into play. And that means that the size of the global economy will be about half of what it will be otherwise, if things go well. The per capita income of so-called South will be less than half. The number of people who live in poverty will be much more. The population still be rising. The number of youth who are unemployed will increase. And we really face the prospects of global social explosion. Not just poverty, but social explosion. That is what is at stake. And I would submit that the young generation, your students of today, they will determine what happens to the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now I would like to give the floor to Carlos Ominami to talk about the Global South multinationals. Please go ahead. Carlos said he would speak in Spanish.
First of all, There are translations.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a reminder.
No.
There are translations.
Let me thank Gaff and LSA for this invitation. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to participate in this conference. But please apologize me for talking in Spanish. I think my English is not...
There is no apology.
It's not a language.
No,
my English is not enough good to assure a reasonable presentation and especially to hold a fluent and fair discussion. So I will go in Spanish. Excuse me. Voy a hablar de un tema que es más bien nuevo, el ascenso de las empresas del sur y particularmente las empresas multilatinas. Parto con una constatación, sí, muy fundamental en la línea de lo que decían Enrique García y Enrique Iglesias. En los últimos 30 años se ha producido un cambio muy, muy fundamental en la relación entre el norte y el sur. Para decirlo de una sola forma, el antiguo tercer mundo, considerado como una zona que estaba más bien condenada a reproducir su subdesarrollo, ese tercer mundo simplemente ya no existe. Un puro dato para agregarlo a los que presentaba Enrique. Mientras que hace 30, 35 años atrás, las exportaciones entre los países del sur representaban solamente un 6% del total mundial, en la actualidad estas representan del orden del 24-25%, cuatro veces más. Y, simétricamente, las exportaciones entre países del norte, que en esa época representaban prácticamente dos tercios del comercio mundial, hoy día están en un porcentaje ligeramente por sobre el tercio. Hay un cambio fundamental en la configuración de la economía mundial, cambio que aquí se ha dicho está fuertemente influenciado por lo que ocurre en China. Déjenme decir, lo vi de la noticia importante del último finales del 2013. China ya no es un actor importante en el comercio mundial, es la principal potencia comercial desde finales del 2013, habiendo desplazado a los Estados Unidos. Pero voy a mi tema específico, el ascenso de las empresas del sur. Mi exposición en estos 10, 12 minutos a todo reventar pudiera resumirse de la siguiente manera. Creo que en materia económica, probablemente el hecho más reciente, novedoso y relevante que ha tenido lugar en los países del sur es el surgimiento de empresas de gran tamaño instaladas en uno o más países que son empresas susceptibles de aspirar a competir en las ligas mayores de la economía internacional. Es un proceso reciente porque en verdad solo ahora se puede hablar de un número significativo de empresas que tienen esas características. Han existido en el pasado empresas con origen latinoamericano, de significación, pero eran más bien casos absolutamente aislados. Hoy día hay un número no despreciable de empresas del sur en las grandes ligas de la estructura empresarial mundial. Si uno revisa, por ejemplo, la lista de las 500 más grandes de Fortune, se va a encontrar con unas 50, 60 empresas que ya no tienen su origen en los países desarrollados, sino que tienen origen en los países del sur. Ese es un fenómeno absolutamente novedoso, porque este era un terreno que era prácticamente de dominio exclusivo de los países desarrollados. Estábamos muy acostumbrados, particularmente en América Latina, a escuchar hablar de Coca-Cola, de Walmart, de Carrefour, American Airlines. Hoy día, por ejemplo, se escucha crecientemente hablar de Petrobras, de Falabella, Lantam, Cemex, Vale, en el caso de la minería. Hay un cambio que viene importante y que es bien novedoso. Y creo que también es un fenómeno muy relevante, porque estas nuevas empresas globales que disponen de recursos importantes, por estas empresas pueden pasar las posibilidades de que el antiguo tercer mundo, pueda convertirse en un actor de primer nivel en la economía mundial. Ahora,
Estas nuevas empresas globales, a mi juicio, son fundamentales para que los países del sur puedan tener éxito en una dimensión que aquí ya ha sido bastante subrayada, que es la dimensión de la integración. Sin integración, particularmente los países de tamaño pequeño y mediano, como es el caso de la mayoría de los países de América Latina, no tienen, sin pasar por la integración, ninguna posibilidad de adquirir una mayor gravitación en la escena mundial. Ahora, yo creo que estas empresas pueden ayudar mucho a ese proceso de integración. Pero para que estas empresas puedan cumplir un papel destacado en esos procesos, garantizando la proyección internacional de estos países, tienen que reunirse condiciones que son exigentes. No basta simplemente con la inercia. No es cuestión de esperar a que pase simplemente el tiempo para que estas empresas continúen creciendo y puedan jugar un papel mayor en la integración de nuestros países. Yo diría más aún que la inercia actual no conduce necesariamente a un buen resultado, y para lograrlo, para vencer esa inercia, se requiere, y es un concepto básico, de una política pública. De una política pública que a mi juicio debería estructurarse en torno a dos grandes pilares. Estas empresas, para poder desarrollar, para poder consolidarse y desarrollarse, necesitan del apoyo de los gobiernos. No es probablemente un apoyo financiero, pero es un apoyo en cuanto a armonización de políticas, en cuanto a la compatibilidad de los marcos regulatorios, a acuerdos tributarios que pudieran expresarse o concretarse en una suerte de directiva de los países que facilite el desarrollo de estas empresas. Y, por otra parte, creo que esas empresas debieran poder también comprometerse con ciertos códigos de conducta que involucren ciertas normas, el respeto a ciertas normas de comportamiento en cuestiones tan fundamentales como competencia, derechos de los consumidores, respeto a las normas ambientales, respeto a las normas laborales, respeto también a normas de probidad. Ese es el punto básico que a mí me interesa hacer en esta presentación. Reconocer este fenómeno y entender que hay aquí una posibilidad importante de avanzar en una integración que todavía es muy incompleta en nuestros países. Voy argumentando de manera muy telegráfica. Hago una prevención. Hablaré fundamentalmente del caso que conozco, que son empresas, las empresas multilatinas. Declaro inmediatamente que no tengo ninguna competencia mayor como para hablar de las empresas asiáticas, de las empresas africanas. El tema de las multilatinas, en todo caso, es suficientemente vasto como para poder tratarlo en su particularidad. Vamos. Es claro que América Latina ha tenido en las últimas dos décadas, resultados que son muy positivos. Ha tenido crecimiento, estabilidad macroeconómica, cuentas ordenadas, reducción de la pobreza. Esto es nuevo, es una historia nueva la que vive América Latina. Pero, es importante también entender que persisten vulnerabilidades, yo diría básicamente dos: desigualdades sociales y regionales muy profundas, y la base de todo esto, que aquí también se ha dicho, una estructura productiva que sigue siendo heterogénea y muy dependiente de recursos naturales y muy poco intensiva en innovación y en trabajo calificado. Esa es nuestra principal debilidad. Es por eso que América Latina sigue ocupando una posición marginal todavía en las grandes cadenas de valor a nivel mundial. En América Latina no están instaladas las grandes fábricas que estructuran la economía mundial. Creo yo que un factor crucial de explicación de esta marginalidad es justamente la atomización de nuestros países y las serias limitaciones que han tenido los procesos de integración. Tuviéramos una integración más consistente, probablemente podríamos tener una mayor inserción en esas cadenas mundiales de valor. Yo creo que hay que sostener con mucha fuerza que sin integración no hay futuro, no hay un gran futuro, incluso para un país grande como Brasil. Si Brasil no es capaz de desarrollar una política de integración en su área, difícilmente también podrá constituirse, como Brasil aspira, a ser una potencia relevante en la economía mundial. Ahora bien, yo creo que los esquemas de integración que han sido impulsados por los gobiernos con grandes esfuerzos durante los últimos 40, 50 años, no han dado hasta ahora todos los resultados esperados. Los esfuerzos más profundos de integración, como Pacto Andino en su época, como Mercosur en la actualidad, no han sido capaces de generar una transformación productiva de primer nivel. Yo agregaría inmediatamente lo siguiente, que contrariamente a lo que algunos han sostenido, los tratados de libre comercio tampoco han aportado una solución. Los TLC han conseguido en algunos casos potenciar nuestros intercambios, pero sin alterar sustancialmente la naturaleza de esos intercambios. En este sentido, el elemento más dinámico en la evolución comercial de América Latina ha sido la demanda china. Ahora, digamos que esa demanda china, que es extremadamente dinámica, extremadamente importante, es una clara demostración de lo que estamos diciendo. Lo que busca China, y a mi juicio, desde el punto de vista de ellos, con toda razón, es básicamente materias primas. Y por tanto, entonces, seguimos reproduciendo un esquema que en ese sentido se parece mucho al viejo esquema centro-periferia. Ahora bien, yo creo que hay que afirmar también con mucha fuerza que, siendo la integración un proceso fundamental, no hay dos vías distintas, no hay dos vías alternativas para la integración. No hay una vía pública que impulsada por los gobiernos y otra vía privada a través de las empresas. Creo yo que el gran déficit de los actuales procesos de integración ha sido justamente la ausencia de actores empresariales relevantes comprometidos con ese proceso. Sin esos actores empresariales relevantes, los acuerdos entre los países, particularmente en las condiciones actuales donde los países, los gobiernos tienden a perder capacidad económica, digo que los acuerdos entre esos países no pasan mucho más allá de ser construcciones más bien administrativas, más bien burocráticas, sin alcances mayores. Estamos en consecuencia en un punto en que los gobiernos no tienen ninguna posibilidad de avanzar solos, sin alianzas con estos sectores en materia de integración. O se genera una alianza sólida entre gobiernos y empresas, o simplemente no habrá integración en la forma como históricamente la hemos pensado. Ahora bien, y voy terminando, presidente, por otra parte, si todo este proceso queda simplemente librado a las inercias dominantes, sin la intervención de ninguna política pública, es muy probable que muchos de estos emprendimientos interesantes que han surgido durante las últimas décadas en América Latina terminan siendo subordinados a la lógica de los procesos transnacionales más convencionales que tienen como eje a los países desarrollados. Creo que un ejemplo interesante en este campo es el caso de la empresa Corona. Corona es una gran empresa mexicana que hizo un gran esfuerzo para ubicarse en el mercado de la cerveza a nivel mundial, pero hoy día Corona ya no es una empresa mexicana. Corona fue comprada por Coca-Cola. Creo yo que las masificaciones de este proceso de absorción de empresas multilatinas, en este caso, absorbidas por grandes empresas multinacionales de los países desarrollados, imposibilitaría naturalmente una integración profunda entre nuestros países y la generación de una estructura productiva moderna. Yo creo que existe una posibilidad seria, un riesgo serio de que esto ocurra, pero esto no es inexorable. Creo que es posible construir, y esa es la idea que quiero plantear acá, es posible construir una vía distinta a la transnacionalización convencional. Y para eso creo que es muy importante este surgimiento de estas empresas multilatinas de las cuales estamos hablando. No tengo tiempo para entrar en los detalles, pero digamos que aquí hay varios centenares de empresas que están cumpliendo con esas condiciones. Algunas de ellas son empresas de muy primera línea en sus sectores de actividad. Petrobras es algo así como la octava empresa del mundo por su nivel de actividad. Cemex es una empresa también muy importante en el sector del cemento. América Móvil es una empresa muy importante en el campo de las telecomunicaciones. No son solamente Brasil y México, los grandes países, los que hoy día están originando estas empresas. También hay otros países de tamaño intermedio, Colombia, Chile, que también están impulsando ese tipo de empresas. Quiero decir también que justo ahí con el apoyo de los con el apoyo de CAFO estamos entregando un estudio bien, bien interesante sobre casos específicos de empresas chilenas y de empresas brasileñas que cumplen con estos propósitos. Y ahí uno ve claramente la necesidad que surge de parte de esas empresas de tener una asociación con los gobiernos para resolver un conjunto de problemas que, si no se resuelven, limitan fuertemente el desarrollo de estas empresas. Por tanto, entonces, una conclusión muy fundamental de todo esto es que se requiere de una asociación público-privado para empujar las cosas en la buena dirección. Como decía, el desarrollo de estas empresas requieren reglas nacionales claras, armonización a nivel latinoamericano de marcos regulatorios, acuerdos tributarios, mecanismos eficientes de resolución de controversias. debiera haber una directiva latinoamericana o sudamericana que empujara las cosas en esta dirección, y como contrapartida de esto, las empresas debieran acomodar sus conductas a ciertas normas básicas en materia de competencia, en materia de derechos de los consumidores, de legislación laboral, de legislación ambiental y de probidad también. Termino diciendo lo siguiente: creo que un acuerdo de este tipo, una política pública latinoamericana o sudamericana en esta dirección, tendría 13 efectos positivos adicionales. Creo que ayudaría al proceso de modernización de las grandes empresas públicas de América Latina, muchas de las cuales, por razones ideológicas, están bastante constreñidas en sus posibilidades de desarrollo. En el marco de una política sudamericana de impulso a estas empresas, creo que sería más fácil introducir cambio en esa dirección. Creo que acuerdos de este tipo también ayudarían a moderar el sesgo antiempresarial que han ido adquiriendo algunos gobiernos de nuestra región, y permitirían también resolver de mejor manera algunos conflictos difíciles que han tenido estas empresas en los procesos de expansión en otros países. No nombro los casos, creo que son bastante conocidos. Siento en consecuencia que hay ahí una vía interesante, novedosa, a partir de un desarrollo reciente que puede ser muy prometedor en la medida en que hay una política pública adecuada. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias. Let's now give the floor to... É possível que eu conheça mais que muitas graças. Chris?
Yeah. Thank you very much. What I'd like to do is, as a scholar from the international relations field, is to reflect upon the South as a concept, build in some sense on some of the themes that were here, and try to tie together these into a comprehensive picture of the South in world politics today. What I'd like to start with is asking the question, what is the South? We've assumed it. We've talked about it in an economic sense, but I think it lives larger than just an economic concept. I think that one way to understand that is to talk about it in two phases. In my remarks earlier, to talk about, a South 1.0, the South of the immediate period after the during the Cold War, after the Second World War, that Cold War period, as one South, and then the post-Cold War period as South 2.0, another South, one that's built upon the foundations of choices, economic experiences, development experiences, and drawn them into the contemporary period, and has moved from subject to actor, moved from being acted upon principally to, in the post-Cold War era, South 2.0 is an actor, and this is what we are seeing in the agenda today. So, back to first definition. South is a meaningful concept precisely because it forms a source of national and transnational identity for both states and societies. It's not just about the state. It's not just a collection of states operating in a global environment, but it's an identity that has deeper roots, social roots across societies in the developing world. It's an identity that encapsulizes shared experiences, principally of colonialism, imperialism, shared dilemmas of sovereignty, nation building, dilemmas of development, economic development. All of these themes, these threads, draw together and enable the wide menu or wide framework within which countries as varied as Singapore in the early period to Burundi in another period together to identify as the South. South is also a mobilizing strategy. It's a source. It's not just an identity as such, but it's a source of political action, if you like, right? Around which regional development, regional integration can be shaped. Sometimes it's shaped in terms of identities such as Latin America, around these geographies. Sometimes it cuts across those and pulls together different groupings. on that, and political action is the outcome of that identification across boundaries. Much of its institutional form has been developed in the context of the global institutions, the international institutions of the post-Cold War era, Bretton Woods institutions, the United Nations. The UN system has been the central organizing principle around which these identities have been shaped. And it shapes the way the South has operated. Now, how has South 1.0 functioned in that first period? How has it functioned, and what are the implications for norms, for international norms? I'm not speaking to the internal domestic question, but rather on the global stage. And I think this has implications for the South as actor 2.0, that the past impacts upon and creates synergisms with the future, South 2.0, must address. The South 1.0 during the Cold War period had to grapple with a set of dilemmas that I've already mentioned. One of them, what that produced, one of them being nation building. What that produced is a South position on questions of sovereignty, one that ironically was closer to, as the decades went on, the position that the Westphalian, the traditional Western Westphalian position, as the Canadas and the other developed countries of the world begin to move away from a hard definition, a classic definition of sovereignty, South countries hold tighter to that. Why? It's nation building. Nation building project requires strong states, or requires a state capacitized state. So South 1.0 looks at the questions of sovereignty, of non-intervention, and says these are things that we're going to take the classic position on that. And indeed, as I've suggested, ironically, the original proponents of that themselves begin to transform towards the end, or in the aftermath of, change their view in the aftermath of the Cold War. The second major impact of South 0.1 on norms is in the area of expanding the parochial application of Western universalism within international institutions. What do I mean by that? The idea of sovereign equality of states, the idea of right to statehood, the end of colonialism, that whole movement, universal ideas were not universally applied. The South became a major proponent of the application of the rights of man or rights of humans to expand. And they took that to international institutions and promoted that in the United Nations and beyond. And then the third major impact I would posit is that of in the mode of international decision making. The shift towards consensus decision making. You can see it in the formation of say the 1944-45 formation of the Security Council versus the WTO several decades later. Consensus decision making becomes the norm. You cannot take decisions without bringing on board all the players, and that's a product of the South. The South has operated in its own interactions and seeking consensus rather than sort of conventional simple majorities or these sorts of formulations. It's not to say in every case, but I think that trend has influenced the shape of global governance during that Cold War South 0.1. South 0.2, the post-Cold War era, the era where the South is moving from acted upon to actor. What is that going to provide? Well, I think these norms that I've suggested that play a big role become areas of contestation within the South. Do we remain committed to sovereignty in the same ways? In the African context, intervention is encoded in 2002 in the African Union. Okay, certain conditions are met, intervention. So it has a different position on sovereignty than it had in its previous incarnation as the OAU. So we see debates, responsibility while protecting versus responsibility to protect. Debates emerging out of South countries saying, well, there is, in certain circumstances, cases where a sovereignty as responsibility should be questioned. So that is an area of contestation. I'm not suggesting it's going in one direction or the other, but that's where South Point 2 is finding its role as a norms actor. In the case of decision-making, the challenges of reconstructing international institutions which reflect the real membership, the real economic power relationships, the redistribution of power, is one of the key flashpoints, if you like, points of contestation in this era of South Point 2. And the South wants to, has the challenge of turning institutions which, if you broaden participation, may indeed be less efficient, right, in decision-making. Certainly that's the critics' argument. The challenge for the South is to prove that otherwise, to introduce modes of decision-making, be they consensual or otherwise, that enable governance institutions to operate effectively. And all of these things will be taken, and my colleagues have elaborated upon it, will be brought to bear on the key 21st century global issues, climate change, global inequalities, internal inequalities, failed states, etc. These are all areas where the influence of the South is critical to solving these global problems. You can no longer, it is no longer adequate to sideline that portion of the globe in which many of these things, in fact, take place. So I think this is these issues will form the points of contact where new norms and the decision on how the shape of the South's influence on global norms will be evident. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating.
Very good. I would like to thank all the presenters for thought-provoking presentations, and maybe straight open the floor to the audience. If you have any, yes.
Thank you very much for excellent presentations. I'm Maxine Molyneux, the director of the Institute of the Americas at UCL. A number of you touched on the problem of social inequality as a real brake on advancing progress, particularly in the social realm. So my question is, given the search for consensus on questions of policy and economic development, is there an emerging consensus about how to tackle inequality, given that we all know how very difficult it is to do that short of social revolution? So my question is, what policies work? What policies are being supported? Where do you think the initiative lies in a context where political and economic elites are far from committed to bringing about the kinds of social changes that we would like to see in this direction? Thank you.
Let me, would you like to start hand and then
let me start. Mr. Lohani has also done a lot of work in this and his colleagues, so we could probably jointly try to respond. First, let me say that the concept of inequality and disparities is a relative one and is very different in my view, as I mentioned earlier, than the issue of absolute poverty. The two are related, but they're different in the sense that irrespective of the average GDP per capita of a country, the issue of inequality and disparities could still be very big, even though the absolute number of poor is not that large. It is because of that there is now a lot of recent thinking on the subject. I think the documents produced by the Indian Planning Commission, both in the previous plan and the new one, are quite relevant. The previous plan, which is just over, 5-year plan, talked about towards higher and more inclusive growth. They linked for the first time higher growth with inclusiveness. The term inclusive growth actually partly started from there and was reflected in Asian Development Bank's long-term strategic agenda. You read quite a lot about inclusive growth in that. The latest Planning Commission of India's report elaborates on that and puts greater emphasis on rural development, on agriculture, and fundamentally much more emphasis on things like education, health, availability of clean water, and so on and so forth. So they defined that inclusive growth is much more than just efforts to reduce poverty. They have to bring equality of opportunity to people, to remove barriers through which some of the people in backward areas or poor are unable to participate in the markets despite the theory, and the trickle-down theory doesn't work for them. So the basic concept really is to create equality of opportunities, beginning from the childhood, the issue of health. Because if you don't have good health when you're 2, 3, 5 years old, your brain doesn't develop, and then you are, you know, hampered for the rest of your life. So the issue of health has become much more important than it used to be. Same is the issue of rural infrastructure. The question, how far are you from a paved road? Do you have access to clean water, pipe water, in your house, not just in the community? Do you have access to electric power 24 hours a day so that, in addition to other things, your children can study? So those kind of concepts, I think, are beginning to emerge more and more now. And it really goes back to what people said in 1950s, and it fell out of fashion. Comprehensive rural development. So it's coming back. Bindu.
Well, I think Harinder covered most of it. From our perspective of a development bank, inclusive growth is one very important pillar for this. And how do you do this? One, you do in our operations. If you go back to the early days of our infrastructure, we would build a road, connect point A to point B, and completely forget the people on the two sides of it. We don't do that anymore. We do the beneficiary analysis. We do a lot more social analysis than we ever used to do to make sure that those who are need to be brought in are done. So that's that you make that as a matter of your principle in your operation. Second, you start focusing your investment in some geographical sectors which have been neglected. Harinder mentioned rural, but if you look at the experience in China, our own investment in the early days were in the coastal areas, the Shanghai, Guangzhou, which is the rapid growth area. And now both the government and ourselves, we are all moving into the inner states where there are poor people. And it's very easy. You go to some provinces and you find 70-80% of people are poor. So you don't need any study to say this is where some investment has to happen to make opportunity. The key point which, the second point which Harinder mentioned, which I think is very critical, is the access to opportunities. And there are two areas, based on every research that's been done, so which is worth doing, is for education and health. And this is where we started borrowing some of the concept of the conditional cash transfer. I think in the early days, it was almost seen like a subsidy. It's not. We see this as you grow richer, you have a lot more money in your reserves. There's nothing. You need to look after your people. And I think some of the conditional cash transfer type arrangement, where you don't give the money directly, but you pay for the services. If the parents take the child to school, the fees get paid. If you take the child to hospitals, you get your health bills paid. And this kind of modalities are seen as the right thing to do, which in the early days sometimes we said is subsidy, you can't do that. Questionable part, the third part, the Asia, at least the emerging countries which are getting richer in Asia, they haven't done enough on social protection. And the question is, why not? These are your citizens. You've made tremendous amount of reserve. You need to take care of your people. And I think more and more such insurance mechanisms plus et cetera are considered as the right thing to do. But it is not yet there. The kind of thing which are questionable at the moment, which Harinder can say more, is India is providing now food, right? Minimum food for everybody, minimum employment of 100 days. I mean, those are, I think, are questions. As long as you can pay, is fine, I guess. That's the thinking, that if I'm rich, I can pay for it, is okay. But if it's creating a fiscal dent, then it's a different matter. I won't comment on that. There are several views on that. But once again, to us, the inclusive growth, creating opportunities, that's access to opportunity and social protection are three focus that we are taking at the moment, at least in Asia.
Carlos, would you like to add something on it?
Sí, yo quisiera agregar algo más desde la perspectiva latinoamericana. En los últimos años se ha producido un cambio que es muy importante en este plano, del énfasis en los temas puramente de pobreza, se ha ido pasando a los temas de desigualdades, que no son lo mismo. Uno puede tener avances muy importantes en la lucha en contra de la pobreza, reducir fuertemente el número de pobres y mantener o incluso ampliar las desigualdades. Yo diría más aún que varios de los conflictos recientes, que movilizaciones importantes que han tenido lugar en América Latina, el caso de Brasil, las movilizaciones de Brasil el 2013, a mediados del 2013, las movilizaciones de Chile del 2011, son básicamente movilizaciones de capas medias. No son movilizaciones de los sectores pobres. Son justamente muchos de esos pobres que salieron de la condición de pobreza, que hoy día están en los estratos bajos de las clases medias, que tienen nuevas reivindicaciones y protestan por ello. Entonces, yo creo que eso es bien importante de entender. Siguen planteados problemas de pobreza, pero entran con mucha fuerza en la agenda pública los problemas de desigualdades. Para enfrentar la pobreza, por lo menos en el corto plazo, se puede hacer con mecanismos de redes sociales, de focalización, de transferencias de ingresos. Las desigualdades no se pueden enfrentar de la misma forma. Las desigualdades, creo yo, tienen que ver finalmente, de manera muy fundamental, con un cierto tipo de estructura productiva. Eso es lo que está detrás. Y eso ya no se resuelve con políticas puramente asistenciales, con políticas de transferencia directa. Son importantes para sacar a la gente de la pobreza, pero esas políticas no aseguran un resultado durable, ni mucho menos un enfrentamiento adecuado, eficiente a los problemas de desigualdad. Para eso, yo creo que los temas de desigualdad hay como tres conceptos claves. Hay que transformar la estructura productiva, ir en la dirección de estructuras productivas más sofisticadas, con mayor valor agregado, y para eso tres cuestiones básicas. Hay temas de educación, capacitación de la fuerza de trabajo. Hay temas también de financiamiento de esto, la reforma fiscal. Países que tienen 18, menos de 20% de presión fiscal difícilmente van a poder financiar este tipo de programas. Y otro punto que es muy importante son las normas laborales. Si los trabajadores no pueden negociar, los aumentos de productividad que se van generando tienden también a reproducirse las desigualdades sociales. En nuestros países pasa algo que no pasa en los países desarrollados. En la mayoría de los países desarrollados, si uno trabaja, tiene un trabajo formal, deja de ser pobre. En nuestros países uno puede tener trabajo formal y seguir siendo pobre. Eso tiene que ver con las condiciones laborales.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, can I?
Okay.
Just very quickly, I think the issue of opportunity also goes back to issue of access to capital. For poorer people, how do they get access to credit so that they can start small businesses or do improvements in their households or pay for children's education? Linked with that, I think a big issue is education and health of girls. Because in most societies that I know, very often the families give preference to education and health of boys and undernourish girls or do not send them to school as long as they should be going. So that's very important. I also think the issue of corruption
is very central in terms of providing opportunity, equal opportunity to all. And that's where what the Indians are trying could be an interesting example to the rest of the world. They're giving everybody an ID card, electronic ID card, and they're going to link the ID cards to the bank accounts, and therefore all of the transfers from the government will go directly to people, and the sticky fingers in the middle, which keep currently, in my view, 50, 60, 70% of the money, will no longer be taken by people in the middle. And that could be an important part of inclusion, if you will.
Thank you. We have one question there then, Dr. Yes. Janet.
My name is Eloy Garcia, no relation, no blood relationship to the rich Garcia.
Who is Garcia?
Yeah, no blood
Garcia.
Relationship to the rich Garcia. We're good friends, though.
Yeah. Okay.
My question goes to Mr. Ominami and has to do with the following. This emergence of the, transnational or cross-border South-South corporations. To what extent has this emergence been related to the expansion of business schools in the South? Not necessarily students going to the Anglo-Saxon world and getting a business education, but you know the expansion of business schools proper in these South-South regions. And the second question, which is for the whole panel, is what do you think business schools should be teaching in the context of the global commons and in the context of the global goods? I forgot to mention, I belong to the Johns Hopkins University Care Business School and I'm also visiting professor at IE University in Madrid.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe you start first, and then see there are two questions. After that, I'll give you
no, muy brevemente, yo creo que efectivamente las escuelas de negocios juegan un papel importante.
Han jugado
y deberían seguir jugándolo probablemente más. Yo creo que en el marco, por ejemplo, de los procesos de integración de nuestros países, debiéramos tener también una preocupación porque las escuelas de negocios fueran parte de estas sensibilidades. En general, las escuelas de negocios en nuestros países están muy vinculadas con los países del norte y poco integradas entre sí. Creo que sería interesante tener, por ejemplo, un diálogo, mecanismos de formación más interesantes con Brasil, con México, con los grandes países, de manera de que todo lo que sea también el desarrollo de negocios del tipo de los que desarrollan las multilatinas tengan una base profesional más importante. Yo agregaría en todo caso, no tuve tiempo para decirlo en la presentación, que las razones principales por las cuales se produce esta constitución de empresas multilatinas tienen que ver con varios factores, tienen que ver con diversificación del riesgo, tienen que ver también con búsqueda de mercado, tienen que ver también con búsqueda de recursos. El caso de las petroleras, por ejemplo, Petrobras va a otras partes a buscar recursos. Una empresa grande como Codelco en Chile también está buscando recursos, haciendo prospección en otros países. Pero siento de que debiera haber también una base empresarial, una gerencia de alto nivel que pudiese estar comprometida también con este esfuerzo. Porque yo reitero, mientras no haya una asociación estrecha entre los gobiernos y las empresas, la integración en el mundo contemporáneo no va a poder funcionar.
Yes, on the second part of the question, would you like to start? What should business school be teaching?
I think we all may have
viewed. The former professor.
Okay.
Just one or two points from my perspective. In my home, I have two children. Both claim they are green. One cares only about the green dollars. He's on the investment banking. The other is really a green, the global green, environment, climate change, people, etc. I think the green dollar,
green budget.
Really, I think with the education there has been, you are successful if you make more money, profit. And we know the typical business schools, the never in their mind the idea of inclusive business comes in, it's too small. Never in their mind think of the people as the target, but the profit as the target. Never think about the real green. I also have many, you know, one time I was doing a finance vice president bank, so dealt quite a bit with the investment bank. I was trying to do a green bond. It happened finally because I was the vice president pressing my investment bankers to do it, but it was not their liking. I think then I was trying to get them to do some CSR work. Yeah, it's no problem. We'll make lots of money and give you a portion to do a CSR by somebody else. Now, that's not the mindset. You've got to be CSR-minded on day one. You've got to be part of that agenda on inclusiveness to the people, society. I think the business school need to reform. And maybe many of them are doing it. I haven't looked at the curriculum yet. But the recent ones that we see it and we recruit are the same. I just recruited someone and asked when I was giving an induction lecture. This person raised a hand and said, well, I thought coming from the investment banking to development bank would be easy. I don't have to work very hard. And I said, I still have to work hard, but I have no bonus. So I said, look, my response was very clear. You're in the wrong bank. You'll never get bonus. If you need bonus, please go back where you get the bonus. I think I haven't seen, and I hope I'm wrong here, the reform that is needed in the business school to create real business school graduates. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
That is well said by Bindu. Let me add a few things. I will start by sort of going back a little bit. That is, I think there is a need to teach a bit more about global commons themselves, what they are, what they mean to the world, to societies, to countries, and to people. Why more trade is good, what are the potential problems with free trade, dumping, etc. Climate change, obviously something which leads to be much. So one thing is a greater knowledge of what global commons are, how they work, what the pitfalls are. And then within that, I think there should be some innovative thinking courses, how these problems can be sorted out at a global level without the old boundaries of developed and developing countries, where there's a common governance mechanism, where the self-interests of both South and the North come together. And I think there's need for a lot more debate, because you're really training future leaders of the world. And then three other points. One, I think we currently are not studying, at least when people like Anil and I went to business schools, we didn't learn that much about the role of business in governance. What positive role private sector businesses can play in improving the effectiveness of governance in countries. Today, a lot of people think it's a problem of the public sector and the politicians. And I would submit that nothing big can be done today without involvement of businesses. And that includes, by the way, the need for much more effective and clean governance. And that needs to be taught. The second, Bindu mentioned CSR. Right now, I think a lot of companies treat CSR as an add-on, as part of advertising or something like that. I think they need to think about corporate social responsibility as an integral part of the business model. And I would submit, for example, Toyota took the lead in creating more clean cars, low pollution cars, like Prius. I think more and more businesses have to think how they can make money and grow their business and still do some social good within the process, instead of just advertising on television or giving grant to LSE or some others. So it has to be integrated. And finally, I would submit, at the end of the day, most of the jobs in the world are created by small businesses. So I would submit that most business schools, again, unlike what Anil and I learned from one of the business schools on the other side of the Atlantic, small businesses, how to grow them, how to create them, are going to be the key to creation of jobs worldwide. And I think business schools need to teach more of that. Thank you.
Should I ask you? Yes.
Yeah, sure.
You're from the university, maybe you can also...
Yes, much of what I would have said has already been said, but I'll underscore and emphasize one or two things. That CSR, as was just last said, has to be congruent, seen to be congruent with longstanding commercial interests. It shouldn't be seen as an offset. I think there is a problem in different sectors, however. I think commodities-based companies tend to view it as an offset. They don't have a market in mind, at least the local market in mind. They see the local market as isn't their point of departure. Those thinking, getting them to think differently is, I think, a bit of a challenge. But you find those which have who are there to expand the local market and take advantage of it will recognize that an integrated approach towards CSR as interests will serve their interests. Thinking of Japan and Malaysia in the 1980s as well, seeing building the economy, building the economic opportunities and selling their goods, building a market for their own goods in that setting. So I would submit that to be important.
Thanks. Maybe I would slightly depart a little bit from my role as a moderator and add also my views. I would tend to think that in different continents, the needs from the universities and business schools might be a bit different. What we see in Africa, sometimes students coming out of school who are so theoretical that they don't know much about, they are not a material that can be immediately be used in on the field, whereas the needs from our countries are immense. One of the things that we also would like to see in universities is to teach entrepreneurship. The days of government and other companies providing jobs to people are gone. People have to look at creating their own jobs. And it is a mindset that has to come from university. You have to teach the student that they also are responsible for creating their own jobs. So that's the submission I would like to make. Can I give the floor to... Yeah, good. Yes, it... Can we bring the microphone here?
Gentleman right here.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. I just arrived from a 10-hour flight, so tired, but I hope I'll be coherent. I just want us to talk a little bit more about South-South Cooperation. South-South Cooperation... Particularly as I listen to my colleague, South Point 1 and South Point 2, 2.0. You know, I'd say, what are those areas on which South-South Cooperation should concentrate on? I want to hear your views on this. If I put forward one or two, one is, I think South 2.0, cooperation between South 2.0, should one of the areas they can concentrate on is really promoting better global governance. Because I take it that the norms and regulations that define global governance are still to a great extent based on South Point 1.0. So let us get together to dismantle that. You know, they've been tinkering around it. You know, we tout a lot about it. So, how can this be done? Vindi and God, I would really want to hear you, you know, say that. So that's one area. You know, really improving, getting together within this context of South 2.0 and see how we cooperate, how we don't, and so on to bring more justice, and more equality in the whole sphere of global governance. The next area is really in the sphere of economic activity, and here I would say trade. Trade. I just came from a meeting in Cotonou where, you know, the Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific countries were looking at their whole relationship with Europe, you know, particularly trade area, and how have they satisfied there? And they said these were arrangements that were built on post-colonial thing, you know, and now the thing has changed and so on. How about dealing only with Europe would not enable them to change anything. Because really they are putting a lot of pressure on them. You know, they are saying we want a trade, we want inter-African trade, we want to use trade to push regional integration. Mm-hmm. So, but the EPAs are based on individual countries. They go in there and they force them and they say we want value addition to our products. This is not happening. So this again, I feel, is an area where cooperation within the South can The third is I've been prompted by my landed friend about the whole notion of shared values and so on, and how is it that we could do that. And within that context, I want to talk about business schools. I think the business schools, we should try to cooperate around business schools. Already, Europe and China are collaborating on business schools. They have a big program, which they call CBI, so I forgot the acronym.
That's correct.
In which China put 10 million and Europe put 10 million. And they continue to put resources into that, are building joint business schools. Why can't we have joint business schools in the South? I just had the lady who was driving it, came to see me in my capacity as head of the African Governance Institute, the chair of the board, not head. And she was saying Europe and Africa should get together and do the same formula, the same setup that's there between China and Europe. And then we have Europe and China. I think it was a little bit late. Well, I think this business school development should be done within the context of SASA. I don't know whether you believe that, but I think it's more appropriate, really, than building a business school in Banjul and cooperating in one in Barcelona or something like that. I would. So let me stop here and hear your views on this. Thank you very much.
I see that as comments, but maybe you want to add something to it. Yeah.
Sure. I'll speak to some points of that, and I agree with the analysis of this, that the agenda is an unfulfilled agenda, and it's an agenda that's responding to the past, South Point 1, with the challenges of today, which is... So that requires, to elaborate upon that, the EPAs in Africa, the European Union effort to, in some sense, undermine, deliberately or otherwise, regional integration efforts. But the South, rather than sitting on the outside, can use South-South cooperation to expand that and create an alternative that will reshape the debate in Brussels as well. That thinking is beginning to happen in Brussels, but unless they get this sort of sense of an alternative, the default position will be an old relationship, a relationship that reflects those north-south post-colonial period. I think the part of that mentality shift, again, I agree with you, is on questions of governance. It's about provisions for public goods. South countries have to think about it in those terms for their region, for institutions to be able to be a provider of that. Will buy a larger share of the political voice in these institutions to demonstrate a willingness and ability to deliver that will change the mentality, I think, of the northern countries. The danger, as we've seen, there were all those in crisis. We see the opening up of governance institutions to emerging powers. The effective. It seems to us, once the crisis is settled down, we see little movement, not much further movement. Mm-hmm. The real crisis will come if there is no movement, because the economic strength of the developing world or South continues to expand, and not given the adequate representation at the halls of power will produce the sort of move from a reformist South, to one that's a revisionist South. And it's really up to the northern countries, I think, to decide whether they want to accommodate, because they're going to create the case for revisionism if they don't do so.
Yes,
sir. To provoke debate, if you would, let me submit that we also need to begin to think about South 3.0. We need to go beyond 2.7.
Because not 2.5.
I will go to 3. Let's think of where we may be in 2050 if things go well. And I would submit, and we've said it to some of the governments, I think a time is coming that gradually we need to change the mindset from us versus them to us. I'll tell you what I mean. In South 1.0, there was a rich man's club, and they were the group of 77 who were on the outside, maybe recently independent, but they were still developing statehood, etc. But if the world is going in the direction I was suggesting earlier this morning, there'll be a lot of sharing of interests. Increasingly, what are today the developing countries will become members of the global economic club, inside members. China is already there. I think Japan is already there. We're going to get India's and Brazil's and Mexico's, etc., coming there. I think we need to think about what that means in terms of cooperation. And I would submit in South 3.0, we'll need to go beyond thinking of South versus North. We need to think about one world, where we have common interests and how to get there. Now, it may be utopia, but I think it's coming. Otherwise, all the influential South countries will join G20 or a successor. And they'll be making decisions, and they'll leave the other 100 countries out. We need to think of that. We need to think of that.
Just two more questions, because I've seen the two hands. And then we close, because it's already time. Yes, gentlemen, and
thank you. My name is Osvaldo Rosales, Director of International Trade Division of ECLAC, Economic Commission of Latin America. I would like to put a controversial issue, probably making a bridge with the next panel.
Well, we know that
the South-South outcome are impressive in the last 10 or
20 years.
Include China from these figures, the outcome may be something different. Then my question is, how much of this process is explained mainly by China eruption in the world economy, and obviously with its linkages with Asia, African, and Latin American countries? In other words, how much this process is China dependent, or
how much is explaining, or how much
relies on endogenous transformation in the rest of South-South economy, including productive transformation? Of course, there is there are huge differences between Asia, Africa, and America. But anyway, higher relevance
of endogenous transformation, more sustainable will be process.
We know that for the immediate next years, the outlook in terms of financial and trade scenario will be less promising for South-South economy. So, I would like to know what is your perception about this issue in the medium and long run.
Would like to comment on that?
You know, in many ways, you're right that China is a very big factor in what happens to the global economy in the next 20, 30 years or so, simply because it's the largest country in the world in terms of population. It has been improving productivity very fast. It invests something like 45% of GDP, one of the highest in the world. And somehow it has become a successful global factory. It faces many challenges, including one that Bindu mentioned, what to do to western part of China. How do you spread, if you would, the affluence away also from coastal areas? But if you look at the basic economics, how countries grow, there are basically three factors. There's labor, in case of China, China is going to follow Japan fairly quickly, and its population will begin to decline as China, Japanese population is already coming. So that's not going to be a big factor in growth. The second is investment. And China's investment rate has to come down so that people can enjoy the benefits of affluence more. So instead of 45%, it may come down to 35, ultimately 30. That's what we are assuming in our modeling. And then is the issue of productivity, which is much more in hands of the country and businesses, etc. Overall, we believe that China's growth rate probably has peaked. It will gradually decline, not collapse, gradually decline, first to 7%, 7.5%, and gradually to 5%, and then perhaps towards the end of the 40-year period, closer to 3.5% or so. Because it would have converged with the best practices much more, and people need to consume more. So who are going to follow China? There's India right behind it. Okay, and our estimates indicate that if you look at the world as a whole, for the next 40 years, roughly 40% of incremental growth of the world economy is going to come from just two countries, China and India. Initially China, and gradually India will catch up, and then India will provide more growth in the period from 2030 to 2050. But that's not the end of the story. I also mentioned earlier, there is Indonesia, a very large country. There is Brazil. There is Mexico. So the challenge is, how does the world make this transition where China could slowly slow down for its own sake, not because of the rest of the world, and other countries take up? Okay? And I think that is a win-win situation for everyone. And one should not fear that by 2025 or maximum 2035, China will become, by the momentum, the largest economy in the world, outstripping the U.S. But then others are behind them. Just the way Europe peaked its growth rate and the U.S. now, other countries are going to come because of the catch-up and other reasons. So I would not worry that much about it. I think what's happening in China today is high growth rate is good for everyone, including the Chinese to begin with. But for Europe, for U.S., for rest of the developing countries, certainly they have exported prosperity to the neighboring countries, to Vietnam, to Cambodia, Bangladesh now, Indonesia. What we need is that India does the same thing in South Asia, Brazil does the same thing in South America, and Mexico does it in Central America. Then you have, you know, and I think President Iglesias has already mentioned that we need ultimately then link between Asia and Latin America and Asia and Africa along lines which we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
So I'm much more optimistic than that question.
Yeah, I think we have the opportunity to come back to those topics in the afternoon. I could see it from the session. Just the last point, 2 minutes, and we can close. Yes, it's you, yes.
My name is Colin Lewis. I'm the vice chair of the school and also the University College London. Although perhaps I shouldn't mention that second affiliation here. This morning we've heard a lot about the rise of the global south and the participation of countries of the south in the global economy. And we know that the economic data is very impressive. So it's quite clear that a number of countries in the south are seizing opportunities presented by globalization. Okay, I'd like to be a little bit more skeptical. And the first part of my question is about commitment. Yeah, which countries or regions, in the view of the panel, are more committed to the global project than others? And more especially, why? You know, why across the third world, what used to be called the third world, as we were told, or now the south, do we see wide-ranging degrees of commitment or lack of commitment to the global project? And the second part of my question relates to the capacity of policymaking elites. And this is, again, I'd like to hear the views of the panel on how they feel about the ability of policymaking elites or policymakers to explain to skeptical electorates the costs of globalization as well as the benefits. Yeah, when we hear in many policymaking fora discussions about globalization, it's benefits, benefits, benefits. But we know that there are costs, and I think that electorates have to be brought on board. Are policymaking elites doing this effectively?
Thank you. Maybe just a brief thing. because again, these are issues that can be tackled also at the in this afternoon. Mm. But you want to start?
I'll do a 1 minute
okay.
thing, but just to, on one question. I think diversity is inevitable. That's part of the development. We should celebrate it. I mean, it's the success produces that. At the same time, it will give expression to different interests. We will see that. Every time the demise, at least historically, and we can't predict the future, but we have many books that do.
They don't predict.
Okay. But nonetheless, every time the time has been called on the concept of the South, they've been wrong. There's still there was the end of the Cold War. Well, that had to be the end of this thing that was really an ideological construct or what have you. So I think that we underestimate the desire to maintain an identity that will carry things forward. That's why I made the point about public goods. When we start seeing, and you echoed that as well, we start seeing leading emerging powers in regional bases start operating as some, there are some signs of that, as providers of goods to the region or at a global level, that will re-energize that. But if it's seen to be a division, then you're right. We'll lose that coherency around global policy or public policy at a global level.
Thank you. Carlos, you want to say something?
No.
The last one.
Un minuto. Creo que en el caso de América Latina, un país clave es Brasil, que tiene que ser capaz de comportarse como un líder de acuerdo a su tamaño, y hay un cierto problema con eso. Y en segundo lugar, hay que ser capaces de convencer a las élites políticas que los procesos de integración que se desarrollan puramente en el ámbito público, con estados débiles, sin asociación con el mundo privado, son procesos que van a ser extremadamente limitados. Y ese es un esfuerzo que hay que hacer. No es algo que esté asegurado, pero podría ser también la manera de hacer confluir gobiernos de muy distinta procedencia, distintas sensibilidades en nuestra región, pero que pudieran compartir un objetivo común.
Thank you very much. What is just left for me is to thank the audience for all those questions, and also thank our presenters for very incisive and thought-provoking presentations. I would beg your indulgence to give them a round of applause.